We're in chapter 26, The Ascent Towards Supermind. When we last were together, Sri Aurobindo was describing how as the soul emerges from behind the veil, as we come to know our deepest self, as we come to know the psyche, and it surges forward, it comes billowing forward, suffusing the nature, moving through the subliminal being into the outer rooms of our nature, has a great impact upon it. But it is the descent of the spiritual powers from above, which combined, the psychic and the spiritual transformation, sets a base for us in which we can begin the passage of ascent beyond the ordinary formula of nature that we know towards the supermind, as he calls it, that difficult and supreme passage. He writes, "It is not to be supposed that the circumstances and the lines of the transition would be the same for all. For here we enter into the domain of the infinite. But since there is behind all of them the unity of a fundamental truth, the scrutiny of a given line of ascent may be expected to throw light on the principle of all ascending possibilities. Such a scrutiny of one line is all that can be attempted. This line is, as all must be, governed by the natural configuration of the stair of ascent. There are in it many steps, for it is an incessant gradation, and there is no gap anywhere. But from the point of view of the ascent of consciousness from our mind upwards through a rising series of dynamic powers by which it can sublimate itself, the gradation can be resolved into a stairway of four main ascents, each with its high level of fulfillment." We're going to come upon a number of unusual terms in English in the course of this, so we will pause from time to time to explain as we go. So he's establishing here that the nature of the evolutionary ascent is the same, in a sense, throughout. It is not suspended because we are now dealing with the possibility of rising to a supramental consciousness. The same cosmic formulas are in play. These gradations, and he's talking here again of the four, establishing this ascent. These gradations may be summarily described as a series of sublimations of the consciousness through higher mind, illumined mind, and intuition into overmind and beyond it. There is a succession of self-transmutations at the summit of which lies the supermind or divine gnosis. Since he's careful about his choice of words, let's understand what he means by sublimation. It's from the Latin sublimare, which means to exalt, to elevate. And so it's a transformation into something higher, according to the Chambers Dictionary, which is the English dictionary that Sri Aurobindo preferred even more than the Oxford. Transmutation, again from the Latin, transmutare, change, but change to another form, another nature, a different kind of substance, and often is applied in chemistry. Chemistry derives from alchemy. So the idea that through the process of application of a process, pardon me, through the application of a process, one may arrive at an entirely new element, arrive at a new kind of being, a new kind of nature is what's involved in that. So, sublimations, transmutations. Gnosis, from the Greek, again means knowledge, true knowledge. So, what is Gnostic is knowing truly. And so, all these degrees, he's talking about the four degrees, higher mind, illumined mind, intuition, overmind. All these degrees are Gnostic in their principle and power. For even at the first, we begin to pass from a consciousness based on an original inconscience and acting in a general ignorance or in a mixed knowledge ignorance to a consciousness based on a secret self-existent knowledge, and first acted upon and inspired by that light and power, and then itself changed into that substance and using entirely this new instrumentation. There you see alchemy. In themselves, these grades are grades of energy substance of the spirit. For it must not be supposed, because we distinguish them according to their leading character, means, and potency of knowledge, that they are merely a method or way of knowing or a faculty or power of cognition. They are domains of being, grades of the substance and energy of the spiritual being, fields of existence, which are each a level of the universal consciousness force constituting and organizing itself into a higher status. Hence, echoes, evocations of Satchit-Ananda all through this. When the powers of any grade descend completely into us, it is not only our thought and knowledge that are affected. The substance and very grain of our being and consciousness, all its states and activities are touched and penetrated and can be remolded and wholly transmuted. Each stage of this ascent is therefore a general, if not a total, conversion of the being into a new light and power of a greater existence. So when, for instance, we become mental beings, it means that mind has descended in a meaningful way into the body and the life and even the physical mind and changed it, had an effect upon it, so that it is characteristically mentalized. Still more will it be when a higher grade of consciousness descends, as he says, completely. The gradation itself depends fundamentally upon a higher or lower substance, potency, intensity of vibrations of the being, of its self-awareness, of its delight of existence, of its force of existence, Satchit-Ananda, plainly now. Consciousness, as we descend the scale, becomes more and more diminished and diluted, dense indeed by its coarser crudity, but while that crudity of consistence compacts the stuff of ignorance, it admits less and less the substance of light. It becomes thin in pure substance of consciousness and reduced in power of consciousness, thin in light, thin and weak in capacity of delight. It has to resort to a grosser thickness of its diminished stuff and to a strenuous output of its obscurer force to arrive at anything. But this strenuousness of effort and labor is a sign not of strength, but of weakness. So this is in the descent, and that we have to struggle so, that we have to exhibit such tapasya to arrive at any goal is an indication that we're dealing with a dense form of the ignorance, which does not easily relieve itself of its burden of darkness. As we ascend, on the contrary, a finer but far stronger and more truly and spiritually concrete substance emerges, a greater luminosity and potent stuff of consciousness, a subtler, sweeter, purer, and more powerfully ecstatic energy of delight. In the descent of these higher grades upon us, it is this greater light, force, essence of being and consciousness, energy of delight that enter into mind, life, body, change and repair their diminished and diluted and incapable substance, convert it into its own higher and stronger dynamis of spirit and intrinsic form and force of reality. So with the descent, it begins to reveal the innate powers of Satchit Ananda which lie within. And this, of course, is a yogic process which has been exampled in his own being and exampled also in his record of yoga, where he writes about his experiments in this field. This can happen, he writes, because all is fundamentally the same substance, the same consciousness, the same force, but in different forms and powers and degrees of itself. A taking up of the lower by the higher is therefore a possible, and but for our second nature of inconscience, a spiritually natural movement. What was put forth from the superior status is enveloped and taken up into its own greater being and essence. The idea that whether we're talking about Satchit Ananda in a transcendental sense, or Satchit Ananda immanent in the world, Satchit Ananda buried, concealed in the inconscient, it is the same substance, the same consciousness, the same reality, always. So this is non-dualism. Sri Aurobindo may be using language that describes variegated phases of being, the self-concealing of the Supreme Consciousness deliberately in what ignores its own being and becomes ignorance, from which, from that steep, inconscient base, we climb back to reclaim the higher consciousness. But always, it is the same being. There is only one being. There are not two. But for our second nature, he writes, second nature means, you know, a deeply ingrained habit of being. We're used to being this lower thing now, and so. Our first decisive step out of our human intelligence, our normal mentality, is an ascent into a higher mind, a mind no longer of mingled light and obscurity or half-light, but a large clarity of the spirit. Its basic substance is a unitarian sense of being with a powerful multiple dynamization capable of the formation of a multitude of aspects of knowledge, ways of action, forms and significances of becoming, of all of which there is a spontaneous inherent knowledge. This is a higher mind. This is not the philosophic mind. The philosophic mind belongs to a lower ordinary range of the intellect. It may be the top of what is available to ordinary humanity's mind, but it is not equivalent with the higher mind. Here, the sense is on the unitarian, on a multiplied dynamization. So it can be one, but can act in multiply as well. Fundamentally based in a secure knowledge. Where is the knowledge of the philosopher ever secure? It is, therefore, a power that has proceeded from the overmind, But with the supermind as its ulterior origin, as all these greater powers have proceeded. But its special character, its activity of consciousness, are dominated by thought. It is a luminous thought mind, a mind of spirit-born conceptual knowledge. And while he stresses that it's thought, you can see that it's empowered as well. It's not simply something that contains the capacity of vision, of sight, but it has a capacity to enact, to affect as well. And all awareness emerging from the original identity, carrying the truths the identity held in itself, conceiving swiftly, victoriously, multitudinously, formulating and by self-power of the idea effectually realizing its conceptions, is the character of this greater mind of knowledge. This kind of cognition is the last that emerges from the original spiritual identity before the initiation of a separative knowledge, base of the ignorance. It is, therefore, the first that meets us when we rise from conceptive and ratiocinative mind, our best organized knowledge power of the ignorance, into the realms of the spirit. It is indeed the spiritual parent of our conceptive mental ideation, and it is natural that this leading power of our mentality should, when it goes beyond itself, pass into its immediate source. So in terms of the involution, it is from the higher mind that is derived in the involutionary movement, what we call mind. And so as we leave mind to ascend into the spiritual heights, again, we meet that from which we came, higher mind. So you can see here, again, he's talking not simply about its conceptions, but about also the capacity to realize its conceptions, different from the ratiocinative or ratiocinative, if you prefer, both are correct. And that's a word, by the way, which simply means reasoning. So when we say ratiocinative mind, we mean reasoning mind. But here, he writes, in this greater thought, there is no need of a seeking and self-critical ratiocination, no logical motion step by step towards a conclusion, no mechanism of express or implied deductions and inferences, no building or deliberate concatenation of idea with idea in order to arrive at an ordered sum or outcome of knowledge. For this limping action of our reason is a movement of ignorance searching for knowledge, obliged to safeguard its steps against error, to erect a selective mental structure for its temporary shelter, and to base it on foundations already laid and carefully laid, but never firm, because it is not supported on a soil of native awareness, but imposed on an original soil of nescience. So he's describing here the imprecision of our methods of knowledge through the reasoning mind to arrive at anything secure. We cannot. And we have to proceed point by point, logical step after logical step. Secured, we move forward one step. Securing that, we move forward another step. But with this greater thought, there is no need of that whatsoever. And concatenation means to chain or link together. So what we're talking about here is a series of united, mutually dependent links. Instead of there being a spontaneous, authentic truth, everything is tied together and the logical chain must be unsevered to persevere, to have integrity. So each step depends upon the other. That's concatenation. there is not here, either, that other way of our mind at its keenest and swiftest, a rapid, hazardous divination and insight, a play of the searchlight of intelligence probing into the little known or the unknown. This higher consciousness is a knowledge formulating itself on a basis of self-existent all-awareness and manifesting some part of its integrality, a harmony of its significances put into thought form. So you can see that this is an aspect of consciousness which draws from Satchit-Ananda. Remember, it may be derived from Obermind. Supermind is secretly supporting all that it does, and Supermind is a way that Satchit-Ananda, in a sense, conceives of itself and throws itself out into expression. So always this is present, huh? It can freely express itself in single ideas, but its most characteristic movement is a mass ideation, a system or totality of truth-seeing at a single view. The relations of idea with idea, of truth with truth, are not established by logic, but pre-exist and emerge already self-seen in the integral whole. This is the nature of the higher mind. It can move securely, following one idea out, but it can also move collectively in the aggregate. There is an initiation into forms of an ever-present, but till now inactive knowledge, not a system of conclusions from premises or data. This thought is a self-revelation of eternal wisdom, not an acquired knowledge. Large aspects of truth come into view in which the ascending mind, if it chooses, can dwell with satisfaction and, after its former manner, live in them as in a structure. But if progress is to be made, these structures can constantly expand into a larger structure, or several of them combine themselves into a provisional greater whole on the way to a yet unachieved integrality. And if you flip back to the beginning of the chapter and you look at the fourth citation from the Rig Veda, and that was from Mandala 9, hymn 68, number 5, he says, "He is born a seer, a kavi, with the mind of discernment, manasa, an offspring of the truth, a birth set within in the secrecy, half arisen into manifestation." So, he is born a seer. In other words, you're moving out of the mind into the realm of pure sight. That's the new birth. You're being born into wisdom. And you're capable of discrimination. You can see the real behind the apparent. You are yourself becoming a child of the truth, a ray of the sun's light, so to speak. The birth within from the secrecy is half arising into the manifestation. So the idea is that here is a soul on the move, growing. The real conscious being is about to be born out of the human figure, and what will it be? So back to the end of this paragraph, then he says, "In the end, there is a great totality of truth, known and experienced, but still a totality capable of infinite enlargement. because there is no end to the aspects of knowledge. Nastyanto vistarasya me. This is from the Bhagavad Gita. This is the 10th chapter, the 19th verse, and it says, there is no end to my self-extension. This is Krishna speaking as Purushottama. There is no end to my self-extension. He is transcendent. He is the all-person. He is the person in the minute behind every individual form. He is there. He is here. Cosmic, individual, transcendent. As he describes how this higher mind can construct with ease a system which is inherently harmonious and expressive of truth, is again a reflection of his own philosophy. Because as he came into deep knowledge of what are the energies and the powers at work in the cosmos, as he came into identity with existence, consciousness, power, and the delight that underlie all of that play. As he began to write, he did not have to effortfully compose a philosophy. It flowed out in an integral way. And those who met him in Pondicherry in 1910 were struck dumb at the enormity of his vision as he sat there calmly in a chair and he could unroll the secrets of the universe. He had just arrived. He had not begun to write philosophy and would not pick up his pen to do that, would not start typing on his typewriter for another 4 years. But when he did, we had the Arya and the life divine leading the Arya forward. This is the higher mind in its aspect of cognition. But there is also the aspect of will, of dynamic effectuation of the truth. Here we find that this greater, more brilliant mind works always on the rest of the being, the mental will, the heart and its feelings, the life, the body, through the power of thought. Through the idea of force, it seeks to purify through knowledge, to deliver through knowledge, to create by the innate power of knowledge. The idea is put into the heart of the life as a force to be accepted and worked out. The heart and life become conscious of the idea and respond to its dynamisms. And their substance begins to modify itself in that sense, so that the feelings and actions become the vibrations of this higher wisdom, are informed with it, filled with the emotion and the sense of it. The will and the life impulses are similarly charged with its power and its urge of self-effectuation. Even in the body, the idea works so that, for example, the potent thought and will of health replaces its faith in illness and its consent to illness, or the idea of strength calls in the substance, power, motion, vibration of strength. The idea generates the force and form proper to the idea and imposes it on our substance of mind, life, or matter. It is in this way that the first working proceeds. It charges the whole being with a new and superior consciousness, lays a foundation of change, prepares it for a superior truth of existence. Nama shaping rupa. The higher consciousness, descending with intent. Even our ordinary willed resolutions stemming from the mind as we have it can recast our life. We can make a New Year's revolution and follow it out simply through intellectual force and arrive at a new figuring of health, a new resolve, a new moral being, ethical uplift, opening to the light. Lots of things can happen just from that. But Sri Aurobindo here is speaking about the conscious descent of the higher mind through its idea force, imposing itself on mind, heart, sense, the very flesh, the very tissue of the body. And if the will, as it descends, is to throw off bad health and say, no, arogya shall be here, the absence of illness, that will conquer the being. Simply by communing with that, it comes automatically. You don't go seeking for healing powers, etc. It comes. It brings harmony into the system. Can do it, as he says here, with the idea, the vibration of a strength that follows with the idea, because the idea is not something simply visionary and flimsy and without force. It has great force, because the closer we get to that point of origination where the supermind lives, the more conception and power live together. They are not separate. The more we rise, the more we'll find that they are entwined. They are actually one. They express Satchit Ananda. It has here to be emphasized in order to obviate a natural misconception which can easily arise when the superior power of the higher forces is first perceived or experienced, that these higher forces are not in their descent immediately all-powerful as they would naturally be in their own plane of action and in their own medium. Obviate, from the Latin, means in the way. And the modern usage is to prevent or dispose of in advance, to obviate. In the evolution in matter, they have to enter into a foreign and inferior medium and work upon it. They encounter there the incapacities of our mind and life and body, meet with the unreceptiveness or blind refusal of the ignorance, experience the negation and obstruction of the inconscience. On their own level, they work upon a basis of luminous consciousness and luminous substance of being and are automatically effective. But here, they have to encounter an already and strongly formed foundation of nescience. Not only the complete nescience of matter, but the modified nescience of mind and heart and life. Because all of this rises out of the inconscience, right? And the nescience is a way that the inconscience talks about itself. Thus, the higher idea descending into the developed mental intelligence has even there to overcome the barrage of a mass or system of formed ideas which belong to the knowledge ignorance and the will to persistence and self-realization of these ideas. For all ideas are forces and have a formative or self-effective faculty greater or less according to the conditions, even reducible to nil in practice when they have to deal with inconscient matter, but still potential. So, yes, up above, instantaneous. It sees, it affects, it does in its own realm. Down here, where ignorance holds the field, its impact is lessened. Let's go back and read the footnote where Sri Aurobindo was describing the idea of strength. This is important. He said, the word expressing the idea has the same power if it is surcharged with the spiritual force. That is the rationale of the Indian use of the mantra. So the mantra is the sound body of the deity. It is alive and powerful and vibrant within it. So when you intone the mantra, when you speak it, when you think it, you release its powers into action. It becomes dynamic in you. And the more you identify with the mantra, the more you are the mantra. And that power that's in it becomes you, a cardinal aspect of your being. Back to our paragraph. There is thus ready formed a power of resistance which opposes or minimizes the effects of the descending light. A resistance which may amount to a refusal, a rejection of the light, or take the shape of an attempt to impair, subdue, ingeniously modify or adapt or perversely deform the light in order to suit it to the preconceived ideas of the ignorance. If the preconceived or already formed ideas are dismissed and deprived of their right to persistence, they have still the right of recurrence from outside, from their prevalence in universal mind, or they may retire downwards into the vital, physical, or subconscious parts, and from thence resurge at the least opportunity to repossess their lost domain. For evolutionary nature has to give this right of persistence to things once established by her in order to bring a sufficient steadiness and solidity to her steps. So if this has become part of the nature, until it is fully changed, it has a right to come back. First, it wants to persist. If it can't persist and we shove it out, if through an exercise of will we fling it from our being, it can try to come back in from outside and recur. It hasn't been dissolved. It has simply been placed out into the universe as a whole. Maybe extruded from our being, but always the possibility is that it may be readmitted through a side door. And it can be forced down. And here's the truth of Freud's great insight that, yes, there are subconscious parts of our nature. Things half digested remain there. And then when they get energized for some reason, whatever triggers them, they have a right to ascend. As long as they're part of the evolutionary equipment, they have that right. And so the higher light as it descends has to do battle with all of this. And it is, as we all know who practice yoga, a continuing effort. It is, moreover, the nature and claim of any force in the manifestation to be, to survive, to effectuate itself wherever possible, and as long as possible. And it is, therefore, that in a world of ignorance, all is achieved not only through a complexus, but through a collision and struggle and intermixture of forces. You may remember that Sri Aurobindo wrote about Heraclitus, one of his favorite Greek philosophers, whose attitude is that all is war. Continual conflict. Yes, everybody remembers that, in a sense, he was contemporary with the Buddha in saying that you cannot step into the same river twice because both the river and you have changed. You are a transient being, the river is transient, but also he said the nature of the world is war. That there is a continual conflict between forces which are, you might say, Apollonian, tending towards the light, and forces which are chthonic, tending towards darkness. But for this highest evolution, it is essential that all mixture of ignorance with knowledge should be abolished. An action in evolution through strife of forces must be replaced by an action in evolution through a harmony of forces. But this stage can only be reached by a last strife and an overcoming of the powers of ignorance by the powers of light and knowledge. This idea of the light conquering darkness is, of course, Vedic in its origination. So Sri Aurobindo obviously sees that there is this dialectic between light and darkness, this struggle between the two, which must eventuate in the victory of light. In the lower levels of the being, in the heart and life and body, the same phenomenon recurs, and on a more intense scale. For here, it is not ideas that have to be met, but emotions, desires, impulses, sensations, vital needs and habits of the lower nature. These, since they are less conscious than ideas, are blinder in their response and are more obstinately self-assertive. All have the same or a greater power of resistance and recurrence, or take refuge in the circumconscient universal nature, or in our own lower levels, or in a seed state in the subconscious, and from there have the power of new invasion or resurgence. This power of persistence, recurrence, resistance of established things in nature is always the great obstacle which the evolutionary force has to meet, which it has indeed itself created in order to prevent a too rapid transmutation, even when that transmutation is its own eventual intention in things. No easy miracles allowed. By the rules of the game. So I think that's a good place. We'll put our bookmark there and continue next week. So for a passage which I think is evocative of the pages we just read, we go to Savitri, Book 1, The Book of Beginnings. Canto 3, The Yoga of the Soul's Release. The voice that only by speech can move the mind became a silent knowledge in the soul. The strength that only in action feels its truth was lodged now in a mute, omnipotent peace. A leisure in the labor of the worlds, a pause in the joy and anguish of the search, restored the stress of nature to God's calm. A vast unanimity ended life's debate. The war of thoughts that fathers the universe, the clash of forces struggling to prevail in the tremendous shock that lights a star, as in the building of a grain of dust, the grooves that turn their dumb ellipse in space, plowed by the seeking of the world's desire, the long regurgitations of time's flood, the torment edging the dire force of lust that wakes kinetic in Earth's dullard slime and carves a personality out of mud, the sorrow by which nature's hunger is fed, the estrus which creates with fire of pain, the fate that punishes virtue with defeat, the tragedy that destroys long happiness, the weeping of love, the quarrel of the gods, seized in a truth which lives in its own light. His soul stood free, a witness and a king. absorb no more in the moment-ridden flux, where mind incessantly drifts as on a raft, hurried from phenomenon to phenomenon, he abode at rest in indivisible time. As if a story long written but acted now, in his present he held his future and his past, felt in the seconds the uncounted years, and saw the hours like dots upon a page. An aspect of the unknown reality altered the meaning of the cosmic scene. This huge material universe became a small result of a stupendous force. Overtaking the moment, the eternal ray illumined that which never yet was made. Thought lay down in a mighty voicelessness. The toiling thinker widened and grew still. Wisdom transcendent touched his quivering heart. His soul could sail beyond thought's luminous bar. Mind screened no more the shoreless infinite. Across a void retreating sky he glimpsed, through a last glimmer and drift of vanishing stars, the superconscient realms of motionless peace, where judgment ceases and the word is mute, and the unconceived lies pathless and alone. There came not form or any mounting voice. There only were silence and the absolute. Out of that stillness, mind newborn arose and woke to truths once inexpressible, and forms appeared, dumbly significant, a seeing thought, a self-revealing voice. He knew the source from which his spirit came. Movement was married to the immobile vast. He plunged his roots into the infinite. He based his life upon eternity. Namaste.